To see examples of what we talked about on this episode, along with further information, go to bunchofdorks.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to
Two Dimension Podcast,
the comic book podcast
with no direction.
You're listening to Two Dimension, the comic book podcast with no direction. My name is Don Moore, and sitting across from me is someone that has said, "The present constantly forces us to see things in new ways." That can only be Al Val.
Who's forcing us to see things in new ways?
The present.
Oh, the present. I thought you said the president. I'm going like, oh, well, the present. Oh, yeah. Yeah, that is kind of sad, but I like old ways are good, too. So we'll just leave it there. So what are we going to do on today's show? Are we going to talk about comic books?
Always.
Or are we going to talk about Vic Diaz, one of the great Filipino actors? I want to dedicate this show to Vic Diaz, one of the great Filipino actors of all time. And, you know, we'll leave it there.
There was an HBO miniseries about when Marcos was ousted by Cory Aquino.
Not Pablo Marcos.
Yeah, but they... but anyway, they've shown on HBO. I had a really bad 6-hour tape of the whole series. They've never released it fully, and Al, being the guy he is putting that bad VHS tape for me on the DVD. And when he's watching, he realized Vic Diaz was in it. A lot of the people in the film are popular Filipino actors in the time. Anyway,
that's enough of that. Now it's time to talk about comic books.
We went to Wilson's Book World a while back. You know, we really like to go there because they got just boxes and boxes of dollar comics. And one time we walked in there, and they have a section, you know, of old furniture, couches and easy chairs. And they have a little table there, and there was two giant stacks of old comic books. I immediately went to the boxes, and Al kept calling me. And it was a lot of Joe Kubert Tarzans, among other stuff. There was a couple of those Marvel Kung Fu, Deadly Hands of Kung Fu magazine. And I'm going through the boxes, and now, Don. So finally I walked over there. Never went back to the boxes. I got a big stack. Al got an even bigger stack. It was greatness. It was all comics from the early 70s to some of the early 80s.
Yeah.
So,
Bronze Age, I think, is what they call it now.
We're going to talk about some of these. What I figure we do is...
We've talked about a couple before, but yeah. We'll just talk about the rest.
So what we'll do is a Pull-a-Palooza episode.
Yeah.
And I got my pile over here. Al's got his pile over there.
Let's do yours first.
All right. Well, you get to pull one out then.
Okay.
Don't turn them over. You pull
blind.
No,
I'm not gonna. I'm not gonna. That one there. It's a Tarzan. An issue which I have. Joe Kubert's Tarzan.
Okay, I'm gonna tell you this one right here. I was happy to get. When Tarzan came out, it was 1971.
Or is it Joe Kubert?
It is.
Right.
But DC really made a big deal about this, and I didn't buy them. At the time. It was one of those odd things. I was, I think, 10, 11 years old. And I didn't, I was 9. I liked Joe Kubert, and I didn't. I liked a smoother line. I thought Joe Kubert was a good artist. His covers always amazed me, but it always looked sad. And, like I said, the Tarzan, I didn't really care for much. Now, I go back and read them, and I just think these are breathtaking. It was exciting. And it was really neat how they had, a lot of backup features. You know, they've had other stuff in it. I think it was the first or second DC issue they had John Carter, drawn by Murphy Anderson.
Those are excellent too.
But this one is Tarzan 223, and it's the Pit of Doom.
And it's all Kubert, I think.
It is all Kubert. And what amazes me in here, I saw this online and I didn't realize this is the comic. It has the first page where it shows basically some type of, there's a guy laying there dead with wreckage. and then a double page spread that is worth $200,000 to me. It's basically they're in a temple with all these people around, and this priest is up there with a blade with this blonde woman on the table. You know, Joe Kubert has a sketchy style, but he has tight layouts.
Yep.
And that's something about him is my favorite thing, is how he lays a book out. It's extremely graphic. Now, when I see how he draws, to me, Joe Kubert, no matter what he does, it has a free-flowing, loose line to it. And no matter how tight he draws it, it just always looks like it's spur of the moment and fast. And I've seen a video of him draw with Mobius and Neil Adams. And it's exactly, you know, he roughs things out and he just works that way. But his stories are tight and planned out and extremely graphic. And I love this double page spread. And, you know.
Well, the thing about Kubert is if you look at it, it's kind of subtly simple. You know what I mean? He does the layouts. So look at two panels are just like this big rock formation, but the way he did the panel arrangement, it all fits and it all flows.
Yeah.
And if you look at the characters, they're all well delineated, but he knows where to what to leave out and what to leave in, which is like, you know, the what the best artists do or whatever. So that's what I see mostly in Joe Kubert, that he, like I'll show you here as an example. Where's this panel here? There's a small panel here where he knows exactly what to leave in and what to leave out, because another artist might have taken this small panel here, which I can't find right now, but I will. Here it is. And really drawn the heck out of Tarzan, like added all this definition. But a guy who knows exactly how it's going to reproduce...
Yeah.
We'll leave it very simple. When you see the original art, possibly you look at it and go, wow, that's kind of loose and there's not much there. But knowing full well what it's going to look like when it's printed, that's just exactly all you need. And he's an artist, I think, that knew exactly what to put in and what to leave out. So that's what I see, you know, mostly in Joe Kubert. And then there's always he always had a great command of lights and darks or whatever, but he knows to leave color in. So he's not going to overdo it, but the guy knew how to like spot blacks, and he knew how to be simple and how to be complex. Like in a big close-up there, he puts a lot more detail in it because it's going to be a big close-up. So you're going to see it in the page, but it's still going to be relatively like, you know, a quarter of the page or whatever. So he knows you've got to put more detail. Whereas this huge panel here where there's only like four people in it, look how little he made it, which is kind of interesting and off-putting, but... He left it real simple because it's only going to be like, you know, four people in the panel. So this guy, you know, from all the... He did thousands of pages, I'm sure, of comic book art. He knows exactly what to leave in, what to leave out, and how to lay it out. So he's like what you would call a master of comic
book art. Yeah, he absolutely is. And I guess I always kind of liked that. When he put a lot of detail, it was nice. When he left space, it kind of let the story breathe. It let the reader breathe.
Yeah.
And no matter what kind of layout he did... I never had trouble following the story. You never thought about... And, like in one of the pages you mentioned, all the panels are narrow, and it's showing a cliff, like they're going up the cliff. So it makes you think that this is dire, and it's tall and all that. But he had, like, I think 5-6 panels going across. I've seen other people try to do it. Whenever I've tried to do comic strips, sometimes I try to get dynamic. And every time I'd have somebody read, well, it doesn't really make any sense. Easy to fall apart. Joe Kubert... He knew.
Because in painting and drawing and music, it really is, the more you work at it, the more you realize it's not what you put in, it's what you leave out, and knowing what to leave out, because suggestion, even in movies too for that matter, and all of your art form, I'll just go across the board, it's suggestion, it's leaving out, it's knowing what to put in, because I've seen artists that can't draw as well as Kubert, but man, their work looks beautiful. And why is that? Because they know exactly what they're doing and what they're leaving out and what they're putting in. It's kind of an intellectual thing, but after a while it stops being intellectual and it becomes like spontaneous and natural or whatever. So that's Joe Kubert. The thing about Kubert too was that like he for many years, I never knew him as a superhero artist or anything. He was always the war artist.
Yeah.
So he got pegged into that. So when he did Tarzan, I was like, wow, that's kind of neat. This guy really can draw like, you know, superhero, even though Tarzan technically is, and he is, and he can draw superheroes and beautiful women as opposed to like tanks and guys with helmets and, you know, war and explosions and all that. So it showed a different side of Kubert that kind of opened my eyes a little bit.
Well, he did the Silver Age Hawkman stories.
Yeah, and I hadn't seen those till like for, you know, at least a few years before I knew his work.
You see, I was never, when I was a kid, I thought Joe Kubert was good, but I never really cared for, well, it was mostly war stories. But whenever I get a reprint book and it'd have a Hawkman story in it, it just fascinated me. Especially the first one where it showed Carter Hall and Sierra, you know, come to Earth. And they were flying, and always neat. They always used antique weapons, you know, maces and bows and crossbows, stuff like that. And I remember they went to somebody's door, and they flew in their outfits, landed at the front door of a typical suburban house. And then he says, well, how do you enter? And then Sierra, she leans down and says, you press this. And it was a doorbell. Mundane things everybody sees, but it made it exciting, like it was all an alien landscape and stuff.
And the other thing about Kubert, too, that we forget is that what a strong pen and ink guy he was. Because if you remember, I think he inked the first Silver Age Flash story over Infantino. And boy, you can tell it's Kubert. You know what I mean? It looks like Infantino's layouts, but man, that Kubert inking style like really gave it some weight to it. That Infantino's work tend to be a little wispy sometimes, but when he inked it, it was a lot stronger. Also, Murphy Anderson when he inked Infantino, even though I like Infantino inking himself,
I do too.
Yeah, Joe Kubert was a very strong inker with the brush and the pen and all that kind of stuff.
Well, he always had a kinetic, like everything was moving. It had a flowing kinetic energy to it, and to me, as far as people inking their own work, Walt Simons is the same way, where a lot of times, and I love inked work, and as I always say on the show, I like really strong, clear lines. But Walt Simonson was one apart, where when he inked his own work, a lot of times you see the pencil work, there's a lot more energy to it than the finished, you know, inked work. And the inked work tends to get a little more sterile, which, again, I tend to like somewhat. But when Walt Simonson inks his work, it still keeps that kinetic energy, and Joe Kubert is the other one.
Yeah, I mean, they're almost like, I wouldn't call him the polar opposite of Kirby, but in a lot of ways, Kirby, his work is a little more subdued at times, whereas Kirby was more like, everything was like in your face, you know what I mean? Kirby did know when to let up, when to do like a simple panel, but even in like simple panels where it would be more, sometimes it would be more like well drawn or maybe a little more, like you said, loose or sloppy. Kirby would be very like kinetic and tight. They were completely different artists, but in a lot of ways there was some similarity to their work and their dynamic feel. You know, an interesting thing about Kirby? This is the total non sequitur or whatever. But a friend of mine, the Kirby guy, was telling me that he got an alter ego and had a 3-part interview with one of my favorite artists, Jim Mooney. And he was talking about like comics, and he said that he didn't like Kirby. He said he thought he was a great comic book artist, but he didn't like him personally, which is kind of weird, you know what I mean? Because everything I've heard of Kirby, he was the nicest, sweetest guy in the world, you know. So I guess, I don't know, I guess it's, you know, that's just a non sequitur, but I just heard it today. It was just the strangest thing, you know.
Well, you know, I mean, it is strange to hear, but I mean,
not everybody can like everybody else.
Exactly. I mean, human beings, maybe it's just.
Yeah, and I want to throw another non sequitur in here because I forgot about it. I should have said it at the beginning of the show when we were talking about Vic Diaz, but a great Golden Age, Silver Age comic book artist died this week, J. Scott Pike. Have you ever heard of J. Scott Pike?
No.
He was a really great artist. He did a lot of stuff in the 50s, the horror stuff, but he was most known for his romance comics. He did hundreds of romance stories. So he just passed away. He was living in Sarasota. He was 91. So I'm just saying this in tribute to the man and so we can post some of his work on the blog page or whatever. But yeah, he's one of the last Golden Age guys that, you know, just passed away recently. Again, he was living in Sarasota, which is probably where Nick Carty was living too. So, you know, we're losing him fast and furiously. But, you know, J. Scott Pike was really good, man. He also later became a a pinup artist and a very, very, very good one too. Actually, did some work for Playboy too throughout the years. Yeah, you'll once you see his work, you'll know who I'm talking about. It's really nice. But at any rate,
cool.
So let's do you want to do another one?
Let's go to Al's pile.
Okay.
Which pile do I go through?
Just go through this one and pick whatever you want. Okay. You may have done it before. No. Oh, Man Thing. Ooh, that's a good one. I think it's Greg Morrow drawing that one.
All right. I pulled out Adventure into Fear with the Man Thing, number 10. And this is Cry Monster. Who did this cover?
Greg Morrow. Oh, I'm pretty sure. Nice. Let me take a look at it. Yeah, it's great. It's definitely Greg Morrow. I'm wondering if this is the story that was in... remember there was... you remember Savage Tales? Yeah. This was a story that originally, I believe, was in Savage Tales. The magazine, the black and white magazine. Yeah. I think they just put it back in... I think they put it in comic book form to start the series, you know, properly or whatever. But, oh, yeah, it's beautiful. Great. Another one of the greatest draftsmen. Not only did he do comics, but he did, like, poster art, paperback covers, you know, one of the...
Yeah. Well, we've talked about... I love Gray Morrow. We've talked about him on the show before. I wish we had a lot more work of his. I see... there's a Facebook group about Gray Morrow that I follow.
Oh, there is, huh?
Oh, yeah. And he did a lot of work to, you know, book covers, science fiction book covers, stuff for Playboy. And it's good, but I don't know. I didn't like it as much as his old comic work. My favorite piece he did was the two-part Zatanna backup story.
Yeah, yes.
And I also liked the other one was that one of the he did backups for, I think it was
Vigilante.
Superman.
Vigilante. You remember him doing Vigilante stories?
It was the Superman comic book in the 70s. They had what was it? The World of Krypton.
I remember that.
And you know, different people worked on it. You know, did Murphy Anderson did some of the stories. Kurt Swan drew some of the stories. The Gray Morrow drew some, and he drew my second favorite work he did was How Krypton Got Its Name. And I just, you know, we talked about these on the show in the past, but...
He did. I got it in there somewhere in the room, a Supergirl movie adaptation, but unfortunately it was colored in that flexi...
Oh, flexigraph.
So there's the dot matrix is really off the charts or whatever, but... Now, Gray Morrow, he was doing stuff in the 50s for Atlas. Then he did some of the most beautiful work ever, as well as everybody else for the Warren magazine in the 60s. And then he was doing the paperback. He did a strip called Orion. He did he did early graphic novels along with, like, Chaykin and people like that, you know. But he was like an amazing, amazing draftsman. I mean, drew the most beautiful, some of the most beautiful women ever, you know. And once again, as the years went on, he simplified his style like everybody else does, you know.
Mm.
But always a great artist. And that I think is the origin. That book has the comic book version of the origin of Man Thing. And that art by Jay Hawk, I'm not sure what character it is. Is Bill Everett involved with that or no?
The first story is drawn by Gray Morrow and it's inked by Howard Chaykin, who, again, I love, but I didn't care for his inks on this story. The second story in it, it's a Spell of the Sea Witch. It's written by Alan Brodsky and drawn by Jay Hawk, and Bill Black is the inker, or Black Bill.
Black Bill.
I was going to say, was he the publisher for
ACDC?
Yeah,
Bill Black was, but I don't know if that's the same guy or not. Black Bill, okay.
Black Bill. Sounds like a pseudonym. But, yeah, it's nice, and it's got...
It's interesting. It looks like a Golden Age story.
It has a third story. It's There's Something Strange About Mr. Jones.
Is that Heck? I can't see it upside down. Is it Ditko or
I want to say it looks like Ditko, but it doesn't look like it was inked by him.
No, it's Don Heck, man.
And that's nice.
It is nice.
And I'm looking at the lady in the corner down there. It looks like Don Heck's romance work, really nice.
It's Don Heck, definitely, yeah.
You know, like, we talked about him on the show before. I never liked Don Heck when I was growing up. I'd get upset when I see his name. But I see the earlier work, and it's quite nice. It just shows me he didn't like what he ended up having to do.
Well, I think what it shows me is that he was just better at certain things than others. Yeah, there's Something Strange About Mr. Jones. Yeah, I didn't realize that. Yeah, because in the Savage Tales... magazine, a story of of Man-Thing was only like a 10-pager, so they had to fill like 20 more pages of story or whatever. So yeah, that's a cool book. I'm glad I found it. I mean, that was when we went in there and got all these books. That was like one of the best treasure troves of books that we found when in our comic book hunting days or whatever. That was a good one. That's a rarity that you'd find that much good stuff. So you know.
Well, the funny thing about Man-Thing was DC was advertising Swamp.
And he came out after Swamp Thing, right?
Yeah, that
or
I know.
Or simultaneously, I think.
It was almost the same time. Swamp Thing, DC. I saw these advertisers for it, and it kind of fascinated me. And I remember I'd read a Mad Magazine comic book reprint of the old Heap story they had in there, and I got a little confused, like why all of a sudden there's all these Swamp Thing kind of monsters, and then immediately Marvel had Man-Thing. I never read the stories. When I was in 7th grade, I was talking to a kid, an 8th grader, who liked comics, and his whole thing was the Valuable Comics. He was a big Barry Smith fan, big Marvel fan, but he liked Barry Smith, and he was always talking about the Valuable Comics, like the first DC issue of Tarzan, stuff like that, the Conan issues. And every time I'd bring up Man-Thing, he'd say, because he'd carry on about the Shadow, the DC Shadow work, and also the Swamp Thing. And when I'd ask about Man-Thing, he'd just roll his eyes and not the same. But I'm going to kind of cheat on Pull-a-Palooza because I pulled out a Man-Thing out of yours.
Well, you know what I'm going to do when we take a break? I want to investigate this story in the middle here. I want to find out who exactly Black Bill is. I don't know why it looks like Bill Everett to me. I'm going to investigate it a little more. There you go, Man-Thing number one.
I bought this, again, that famous time when Al made me go over the table. And this is the first issue of Man-Thing, his own comic book. And Frank Bruner drew the cover, and I find that cover, it's like listening to T-Rex. It's awesome and dorky all at the same time, because it looks kind of scary, but it also has kind of a, hey guys, kind of sense of humor to it. I bought this for the cover alone. Now, look on the inside, I mean, that's just staggering, and when I'd get confused when this 8th grader was always telling me, Man-Thing's not as good as Swamp Thing. I always liked his head. I always liked the talons, those three talons.
I think Plug later on changed the three talon things to one or something like that. They did something with them. They streamlined them.
But the inside is drawn by Val Merrick and inked by Sal Trapani.
Sal Trapani, yeah.
Who I've never really...
He's good. I like him.
Steve Gerber wrote it. I like Val Merrick. I don't really care for that. I don't know if it's Val Merrick or if it was Sal Trapani. I tell you, Steve Gerber, he wrote some crazy stuff.
Yeah.
Howard the Duck is in this thing. You got Barbarians. I've never read Man-Thing. I just kind of glanced through this one. I didn't particularly like the art, but I like the fact that, to me, that's a total Al book, because it looks like he opened a junk drawer, grabbed all the action figures, and just threw it in there, and it's got, like, little green plastic army men. It's got Hello Kitty figures. It's got, action figures. You name it.
It's definitely, like, the word I was trying to quote to you. It's got an unpretentious charm to it.
Yeah, it does, and it's fun. I understand.
Even though Gerber got a little pretentious.
No,
but the art has an unpretentious charm to it. Let's put that.
It was reading that Marvel Comics The Untold story. That's where I never read Howard the Duck. I read some of Steve Gerber's books, but I never really read them all the time. And I didn't realize The Defenders is where Howard the Duck and Man-Thing came out of. They said that in there that I guess his Defenders work is just a panel would show up and Howard the Duck would cross through the panel and Man-Thing would show up behind the door somewhere.
I thought Howard the Duck showed up in not the first issue of Man-Thing, but in where he first started. Not in this book, but he was in, I don't know if he was in Adventures into Fear or one of those. I thought that's where they came out of, but I could be wrong.
Well, he was appearing in some other kind of book. It was something. I didn't realize that. I just knew Howard the Duck when the first issue came out. But he's in this one, and it's like I said, this thing is just, it's wild and all over the place.
Hey, let's take a music break now, and I want to research a little bit about this story, and then we'll come back and we'll, look at more oldie goldie come up.
You can hear our most recent 20 episodes on iTunes. If you would like to hear our older episodes, you can find them on our blog. Just go to bunchofdorks.com and click on the Cyclops.
And that was Hayatomi. She's in Japan, and I like her.
There you go. Good enough reason. All right, who's doing the next?
Is it your turn now?
Is it my turn?
I kind of jumped in because I did another man thing when right after yours.
Okay, so I'm just going to grab like this one here. Oh, there's a good one.
All right, if you pull that one, then you have to pull this one too.
Okay, this is a great two-part. I remember buying this when I was a kid. The Avengers, what was it? The Thanos kept it. Everybody and their cousin is in these two books. It's Starlin and Joe Rubinstein, I believe, drew it. Oh, yeah, this is like a classic. This might be the basis for the new Avengers movie. I don't know. Cosmic Cube's in it. Thanos is in it. The whole, you know.
These were strange books. I was in Texas. I went to the little store by my aunt's house. And it was in 1977. And it was King Size Annual number 7 of The Avengers. And had Warlock, Captain Marvel, Battle Thanos with The Avengers. And what the odd thing was Jim Starlin had done The Warlock in Strange Tales. You know, the Adam Warlock saga. And then as that went on, they changed the title and just made it Warlock. And it was Adam Warlock's own title. And the story went on. It was always Jim Starlin writing and drawing it. Sometimes Steve Laiolola would assist him in the art. Absolutely. And we talked about this on an early episode. Dallas had read them. Some of my favorite work. It's my favorite Jim Starlin work. But it never finished. It just, the series, you know, canceled.
I thought it started in this one and it ended in that one. I thought it was a two-parter.
The series... What happened was in this Avengers, just out of the blue, I picked this up, and oh my God.
Probably at a 7-Eleven or something?
Yeah, it was a convenience store, but it wasn't...
convenience store.
It was like, I don't know what it's called, Continental or something. But this picks up where the Warlock book ended. And it's the whole thing that Jim Starlin had been writing started in this one, and Adam Warlock died in it. And
that's right.
It blew my mind because you know Adam Warlock was always a tragic figure.
Him.
Yeah, him from the Fantastic Four. Well, in Fantastic Four, he was just
out of the cocoon, right?
Yeah, he's an artificial human that some group made. And then I never read the Thor stories, but he showed up in Thor as him. And I'm guessing it was Roy Thomas is the one that turned him into Adam Warlock and gave him the soul gem. But, as we talked about in the past episode, a couple episodes ago, Roy Thomas, he never really created things out of the blue, but he took what other people did, you know, like the Vision, you know, he took, you know, that
whole
thing.
Well, he took what Stan did, and he just kept it going, you
know
what I mean?
Which is kind of neat, and I loved Adam Warlock, you know, and like I said, Adam Warlock, it was, even though it was him, it was a lot different than him, but, what blew me away in that Avengers book was when Adam Warlock died, he basically, another Adam Warlock showed up, and a little more innocent. And then he was saying, oh, it's you. And the Adam Warlock that was dying says, of course it's me. You knew this was going to happen. And then, basically he went there to take his soul so Magus would never occur. Magus was his alter ego that started in the Jim Starlin work. And I read that, and it blew my mind. And then I started going to find an old back issues, and in one of those back issues, it showed that same exact scene from a different perspective. I just thought that was some of the most profound work I ever read. Now, the second book here that Al pulled out was King Size Annual number 2 of Marvel 2-in-1. And it was always the thing with somebody else, and this was the thing in Spider-Man, to duel a mad god, and this thing in Spider-Man fighting Thanos.
I thought this one, because this was continued in that one. Isn't this story continued in that one?
No, that one's first. The Avengers is first, and then this one finishes.
Oh, that one finishes it. Yeah, that's right.
But this one has Captain Marvel and the Avengers. And Adam Warlock, again, is gone. I never found this. I saw it advertised. I never saw the book. And it really irritated me pretty bad. Those reprints that I, you know, Dallas read had the finale in it. But when I was there, I thought, well, I never had this. And so I bought it. And I just bought the Avengers as well, just because the other one I had, I read so many times, it's coming to pieces. But this, and basically after Adam Warlock dies, they finish the job with Thanos.
Yeah, some of the best comic books ever made were probably bought at convenience stores.
Absolutely.
And drug stores.
Well, we always talk about that, and that's kind of why it destroyed the comics industry, is when it became a collectible for, you know, some a niche, a novelty. When people started collecting, they stopped being a consumable. They stopped being free popular entertainment or cheap popular entertainment. It became an expensive
hobby,
extravagance that, you know, doesn't make sense to most people.
Now you can buy a meal at McDonald's cheaper than you can a comic book, which is kind of sad. Because back then there were like a quarter or 50 cents. You couldn't buy a meal for 50 cents. So,
but you can get reprints at the library now, which is awesome. So, you know.
All right. Well, here, let me go to this one. Grab one of these. All right.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Adventure Comics.
This is
Action
Comics number 413. And this one is an awesome one.
It's got a beautiful Nick Carty cover.
I saw this advertised. You know, back then, comic books always had, advertisements of the current issue. And I saw this one. It's an old man with a voodoo doll of Superman. He's got a giant pin with a skull into it. And he's poking Superman in the shoulder. In the window is Superman in the air, throwing back in reaching terror, you know, or pain. And it says, "The Voodoo Doom of Superman." And I thought, wow. Well, I was 10, and I was riding the bus from Oklahoma City to Wichita Falls, Texas. And we stopped in Chickasha, Oklahoma. And it was kind of it was a fun trip, because when I was on the bus, there was this kid that came on, like me, by himself. I think he was 10 or 11. And he came and sat with me, and we became fast friends. And anyway, I had comic books. We were talking about Saturday morning cartoons. I remember we were talking about the cartoons we liked, and he kept saying he really liked, I was watching the Looney Tunes in the morning. He said, "Oh, I've seen all of those," which most of us had. But he said he likes Dr. Jekyll, or whatever that is. So, Heckle and Jekyll, which I used
to
watch.
The two magpies. Yeah,
which was awesome. But he, anyway, we stopped in Chickasha, Oklahoma, and they had at the bus stop there, they had a little snack bar, and they had comics. And I pulled this one out, and he was just, "Oh man, you got a good one." And, you know, we got on the bus, so we read it together.
It's got Metamorpho in it, too.
Yeah, first of a new series of Metamorpho, but I don't think Ramona Freyden drew
it. No, I don't think so either.
They tried to make it look like Ramona Freyden. That's Eclipso. It has an Eclipso story as well.
That's Toth, isn't it?
Yeah, it is Toth.
It's a reprint. It's probably why I got the book, because it had a Toth reprint in it.
Well, see, Eclipso kind of freaked me out. It's kind of a neat character, and it's beautiful Alex Toth artwork. At 10 years old, I had trouble understanding the character.
Yeah. Well,
who is this guy? I love him.
I say, Boltonoff.
Oh, is that Murray Boltonoff?
Yeah, Henry. Henry Boltonoff. Yeah, he signed it right there. Yeah, Henry Boltonoff, yeah.
There was another guy named Henry Scapelli that drew the
Henry
same
Scapelli
kind of
did, Archies and stuff like that, too. It says here, Metamorphos by J.C. and Anderson. Now, J.C.? Anderson's got to be Murphy Anderson, I'm thinking, because it looks like Murphy Anderson inking it, but J.C., we're going to have to look that up. By the way, speaking of looking things up, remember that story we were talking about before, the Sea Witch from, where was it? It's from Fear, and it was a spell of the Sea Witch, and we were trying to figure out what it was from Adventures into Fear number 10. Jay Hawk is a pseudonym for Jack Katz, who did the First Kingdom. And Black Bill was a pseudonym for Bill Everett. So there you go, from Adventures into Fear number 10.
Now, looking at the Metamorpho story,
We'll have to look that one up and find out who J.C. is.
It's written by Bob Haney, but it says art, J.C. and Anderson. Like you said, that must be Murphy Anderson.
I don't know who J.C. is.
I wonder if it's it couldn't be Joe Cooper because he's a
no,
K.
No, it was a K, yeah. We'll look it up and we'll figure it out.
But, they're doing their best to make it look like Ramona Freyden. It looks a lot like Ramona Freyden, but then, right here I can tell it's Murphy Anderson drawing some of it.
Breaking.
Yeah, but this is absolutely one of my favorites.
But this is a Superman story. And is it
that's
Oxnard?
That's what I'm just talking because.
Is it Bob Oxnard?
It doesn't say here. By Kurt Swan and Murphy Anderson. It doesn't say who wrote it.
Hmm.
That's so bizarre.
Let me take a look.
Like I said, the cover always caught me. The story, I remember loving it, but I didn't really care. The story, the cover was what excited me, and then the backup strips I always remember fondly. The story was kind of like magician's tricks. When you see magicians on stage and they do some card trip or super escape or something, you're amazed, and then sometimes you find out how they did it later, and you're kind of disappointed because it's not so fantastic. That's kind of how that story was to me.
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out who this JC is. I think I'm remembering the art now, but I can't. You know what? Let's take a break.
No, we just.
I thought we're gonna do another music break.
Yeah, we are, but let's.
You still want to keep talking about?
Well,
it? Okay.
No, I just chose one book. You choose another, and then we'll take a break. We're taking.
No, that's yours.
No, this isn't. This is yours.
Oh, is it mine? Oh, okay, good. All right, so you want me to pick one of your books? All right.
Yeah.
Hold on, give me that. Okay. Okay. Well, we have to remember to figure out who this JC guy is.
Yeah.
Let's see what book it was. It was Action Action Comics. I'll put it up here. All right. Let me grab another one of your books here. Creatures of... Did we talk about this one before?
We have, but I just bought that one.
No, we did. We'll do another one. More Warlock.
Okay, now I'm glad you chose this one.
Did you get that one at...
Yeah, Wilson's, yeah.
Wow.
This is the second issue of The Power of Warlock, which is the old Roy Thomas and a Gil Kane book. You know, this book came out in, I think, 71, the first issue, and it was everywhere. And I wouldn't buy it. It just irritated me. I mean, you could...
Why?
Well, I honestly don't know, but the first issue... It had Adam Warlock in the center, just kind of like this, and on one in the back behind him was Thor and the Hulk, and it was all drawn by Gil Kane, so everybody was in these power poses.
He did all those covers back then.
And he had all that Kirby crackle going around Warlock, and I don't know, it irritated me for some reason. I ended up going back and buying these later after I read this Jim Starlin work. I really actually liked Adam Warlock a lot. I remember when I was reading those... I guess it was the Len Wein, Herb Trimpe Hulks. You know, Adam Warlock was there on Counter-Earth with Hulk, and I loved him. And I felt so bad when I thought they crucified him on that Egyptian Ankh, and he turned into a cocoon again, and I thought he was dead. Anyway, I bought this because it has a fantastic Adam Warlock cover. He's in this pose with all the crackle going on, with all these bodies laying on the ground. And it says, the world was evil, the world rose up against me, and so the world died. And it says, countdown for Counter-Earth. And like I said, I really like the cover. It's a tight... Adam Warlock is one of my favorite character designs. I like his outfit, you know. I like his Captain Marvel lightning bolt on the chest. But, I opened it up.
The Tom Sutton and
Gil Kane. No, I think it's all Tom Sutton. And it says spiritual advisor, Gil Kane.
Okay. John Buscema layouts. And Tom Sutton finished art. So it's John Buscema inked by Tom Sutton. An interesting combination.
But, now Al likes Tom Sutton.
I think he's great. It's more than like. I like Tom Sutton a lot.
I'm the opposite. When I say this, I guess I was indifferent. I've never really enjoyed him. I guess to me, part of the point is Tom Sutton has a I always took him as loose and lackadaisy. Like, he could have finished things a little better, but I think that's what you like, is the looseness
was,
to it.
I like Tom Sutton because he was, like, changed his style from book to book sometimes. He was a very adaptable comic book artist.
Oh, I got
you. He had that loose style, which I do like, but he could actually draw like Kirby if he wanted to, but it was always very fun and cartoony, so yeah, I love his work. Mm-hmm. I really do. That's interesting. I didn't realize that was Buscema, but it was layouts and Tom Sutton. I love his work. I think the guy is one of the most underrated comic book artists of all time for many reasons, including the one you just said. You know, people just didn't think that. People didn't think that that was a good superhero style. It was probably better suited for horror comic books, but I like it. I like it a lot.
Now, I've read him a lot. And,
a lot of Charlton work.
But all the things you talked about, which I agree with, but I was the polar opposite. I didn't care for him. I'm going to say this. He had skill. And he reminds me a bit of Frank Robbins, who, you know, had a sketchiness to it. But I don't know.
Robbins was more of a Kniff.
Yeah, I mean, but there was things about it, I don't know, but I opened this up thinking it was going to be Gil Kane, and I find it strange that it was Gil Kane's series. He did all the covers, he did this cover, but it was the second issue of the series, and they had a fill-in artist.
I think Tom Sutton did work on a lot of those. As a matter of fact, Tom Sutton did the art on the first Ghost Rider, which he was probably better suited for. Than that, and Tom Sutton actually inked Gil Kane, I believe, in a Conan giant size book or whatever.
Really?
So he did a lot. Yeah, he did a lot more. If you ever see his work that he did for them on the Planet of the Apes black and white books,
yeah.
it's greatness, man, greatness. It's definitely an acquired taste. But if you acquire that taste, man, you're gonna love it.
Yeah.
I'm telling you right now, Tom Sutton, one of the greats.
But it's
never appreciated. Still not appreciated. But
well, and I'm in that crowd. When I say that I don't hate him, I never laid in bed just, you know, cursing Tom Sutton. I guess I was just, it wasn't a style I appreciated too much.
Oh, there you go.
But you know, I was just a looseness to it, you know.
All right. Break time.
Gonna fool around with us. No one's gonna fool.
And we're back, and that was Elliot Smith with Angelus.
And who is Elliot Smith?
He's a great singer-songwriter who fortunately passed away 10 years ago, maybe a little longer. Best known for doing some songs for the soundtrack to the 1997 movie Good Will Hunting, written by Ben Affleck, Batman, and Matt Damon. So there you go.
The two actors wrote the movie?
Yes, they did write the movie. They won Academy Awards for their screenplay. Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Uh-huh, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Wow. So this Elliot
Smith... And Robin Williams is in the movie, too, by the way. So.
And Elliot Smith, was he a 90s recording artist?
90s, or? Early 2000s. Mm-hmm. It's sad because his work was getting more and more popular, and then he... The saddest part is they don't know if he committed suicide or was murdered. It's kind of a... Mm-hmm. It's a strange case or whatever, but 90s, 2000s, did about 5 or 6 albums. The last two were really, like, they were more pop-oriented, but hey, that's the way it goes, man.
All right, now, while on the break, you looked up J.C.?
That's right, J.C. from that story in Action Comics from, what was the name of that story? Anyway, J.C. is John Callan, who did a lot of work for DC around the time, and the Superman story. Damn it, I can't find the book. The Superman story we were talking about before. The writer was Leo Dorfman. It was from Action Comics number something or other. So
223, I think.
Was it 223?
I'm taking a shot in the dark, but I think
now I can't find the book at all. We'll post it. No problem. Anyway, so are you? Oh, here it is. Here it is. Here it is. Yikes.
413. I was way off.
413 of Action Comics.
Well, that's close to 223.
Yeah, it is. It's just 200 issues away. The Superman story by Leo Dorfman is The Voodoo Doom of Superman, and the Metamorpho story is The Seven Sins of Simon Stagg. So there you go. Simon Stagg sounds like a porno name or something.
Yeah.
I don't know.
It's awesome.
Anyway, do I pick or you pick?
I don't remember who picked what.
All right, here, just go ahead and pick something.
Pick a book, any book. Okay, I'm going to take...
that one?
Okay. This is The Flash 224. And a solo starring in this issue, Green Lantern. And it says... you have a guy at a podium speaking to a crowd. His back is turned to the reader. And then above in the air is this ghost figure saying, "The Flash isn't fast enough to intercept this assassin's bullet, but I am." It shows a bullet, you know, going towards the speaker, and the Flash is zooming underneath with his hand outstretched trying to catch the bullet. But the ghost hand is in front of the bullet between him and the speaker. And it says, "You'll never guess what happens when the fastest man alive is haunted by the fastest man dead."
And, of course, the ubiquitous cover by Nick Carty.
Nick Carty, yeah. I have to admit, this one's not I wouldn't say a great Nick Carty cover.
No.
But it's...
But, you know, I think those were laid out by Carmen Infantino. I'm not 100% sure.
I've heard that.
I know he laid out Kirby's, but I don't know if he did it for everybody. But.
Well, you know, it's something I it's not always solid, but I know in 82 there was a panel with Gary Groth, Jan Stranod, Cary Gamble, and John Byrne in Dallas, Texas. And they started talking about at Marvel at the time, this was in 82, but Ed Hannigan was laying all the covers out at Marvel, and the artists would follow him. And John Byrne was proud to say that he laid his own covers out. I mean, I'm sure there were some artists that they just said, "You can do whatever you want." I don't imagine anybody laid Joe Kubert's, you know, covers out. I think he just did it himself. But
did anybody do layouts? Kirby. That's right. Kirby's covers were laid out, weren't they?
Mark Evanier had said that in that Kirby book, he said that John Romita more than likely laid out. He says, "Jack Kirby was first and foremost a storyteller. He understood that the covers are an important part of the business, but he wasn't really that interested in doing them." So... Mark Evanier said more than likely John, I don't know if he was absolutely positive that John Romita laid the covers out and Jack Kirby followed him. I don't know about the older ones, but, you know, the later ones. And he said when he went to D.C., I imagine Carmine Infantino laid him out for Jack Kirby. And then Jack Kirby just, you know, redrew him following his own thing. And I don't know how closely. He must have been able to get away with some of it. But, like I said, they always had somebody laying the covers out, you know, for these comic companies. And I guess people understood what made a good cover.
And that's Dick Giordano, right?
No, it's
a... story, yeah. It's Dick Giordano.
Oh, you're right. It's an art by Irv Novak and Dick Giordano. Written by Cary Bates, of course.
And I got to think that I think the backup is by Neil Adams, but I'm not 100% sure.
Let me see. I've never read this one. I always liked The Flash. Irv Novak wasn't somebody I liked a lot. I mean, he's a good artist, but he just, again, to me, he reminded me a lot of Dick Dillon.
Who's the backup by Green Hill Lantern?
Dick Giordano.
Oh, okay.
I tell you, Dick Giordano, he could draw.
He was really good, man.
He was a great, great inker. But, you know, we were talking one time about inkers that, you know, some inkers always had a stiffness and stuff to them.
No, he was fluid.
Yeah, Dick Giordano, I loved his pencil work just as much as his inking.
Yeah, this is penciled and inked by Giordano.
You know, some of the people that are famous as inkers, their pencil work, it was good, but you could tell that they just didn't pencil enough, you know. And it always had a stiffness or foreshortened arms or, you know, there was something off about it or a stiffness. But Dick Giordano, he was the real deal. And whenever he penciled, which wasn't a lot, as I remember, but...
I remember him doing a series for DC. It was a female detective and she wore a white suit. Oh, man, my memory is so bad. And he did like a 4-part series of her, like later on, like in the 80s or whatever. I really liked it a lot, and I can't think of it right now. We'll post it.
Well, didn't he draw the Rose and the Thorn strip?
Sure did.
In the backup of Lois Lane? Because that
sure
was,
did,
that was
yeah.
He had a, I was going to say, he had a, I hate to say it, but it was a Neil Adams kind of style.
He inked Neil Adams in a lot of work. Like, that looks like a Neil Adams.
Yeah. This whole page looks like...
You know what it is? Neil Adams brought that advertising art style to the books. But he had the power, of course, you know. But he brought that slick advertising style. And Dick Giordano did that, too.
Yeah, well, weren't they partners at Continuity Associates?
Sure.
Yeah, so, I mean, it was their thing.
I think everybody worked at Continuity. Like, the Krusty Bunker. Yeah. You ever see those?
Walt Simonson worked at Continuity.
Even people like Pat Broderick did work.
You know,
like whoever was in the room got to do something.
You know something Walt Simonson did? The Grand Funk album
Shining On.
Yeah,
I remember that.
He was a Continuity and the album came, so he was the one that put it together. And that was the one that came with the 3D glasses.
That's the one with Locomotion, isn't it?
I thought that was... Is it?
It was Shining On, the one with Locomotion.
That's what we're talking about, Shining On. I thought it was Girls of the World. Maybe.
No, it was before that.
Maybe it is Shining On.
I think it's Shining On, yeah. I remember. You know the deal with Locomotion was that wasn't one of the songs that was supposed to be on the album. But
yeah.
I guess they used to do, like, before the show, they used to do, like, a warm-up for the show, and the band would sing that, like,
to,
like, get pumped up. And I get Todd Rundgren, the producer, liked it. And he goes, why don't you just do the song as a... You know, do a run through of the song or whatever. And he liked it a lot, and it became a hit single.
No, they were going.
And that's when they started becoming more of a pop band in a lot of ways.
They were going to a concert, and Todd Rundgren was he was the producer for them.
Yeah, he did. We're an American Band.
And they were in the limo going to a show, and they were singing that song in the limo as a warm up. And Todd Rundgren was saying they didn't have a single for it.
They had a single, okay.
And when he heard them do it, before they got the limo, he says, okay, that's your single right there. Just do it just the way you guys did it. Yeah, great band. Great band.
Became a pop band. Still a good one.
I never stopped liking them. I loved them. I loved it when Craig Frost joined them as keyboards and became a 4-piece band. I liked them when they were 3-piece. I just liked them.
You know, Farner was interviewed on that metal show, and he's not bitter because I guess he's like, you know, whatever, he's Christian, he's got his... But he basically said that the other guy, the drummer Brewer, screwed him over. I'll see if I can find a clip from it. Yeah, like, he signed a contract unknowing because he wasn't like a lawyer or whatever, but apparently Don Brewer had some legal thing or whatever, and he signed away... a waiver saying that, like, it, if two of the it was between the three of them, him, Brewer, and if two of the three decided they didn't want one of them, they could like work them out. So apparently that's what happened to Farmer. The other two, like, said, no, we don't want him. We'll just continue as Grand Funk Railroad. And since two of the three are involved, that's what he said. So I don't want to, you know, he said.
Of course, it's all blame
the lawyers or whatever.
Well, it's, you know.
But he's not better.
Well, I'm glad. When they got back together, in 1981?
They got back together a couple times.
Yeah, but the first time they got back together, Don Brewer, I guess, wanted in the contract that Mark Farner couldn't talk about any religious things to him. He was a Bible banger. And Mark Farner wouldn't do it. He says, "Are you crazy? That's my amendment rights, you know, my constitutional rights." And he is correct.
That's correct, yeah.
But, you know, it's like, you know, somebody that used to smoke and stopped smoking, and good for them. It gets so irritating when you start hearing their rants about anti-smoking, you know, and stuff. I mean, okay, but, you know, somebody constantly thumping the Bible, I understand you believe it with all your heart, and that's good.
See, my point of those three is I don't know how bad he was thumping, quote unquote, thumping the Bible. You know, I mean, maybe Don Brewer just didn't want to hear anything out of him. Maybe he would just say, you know, God bless you or whatever, and Don Brewer was bad. I don't know how bad it was.
It could be either way, but I think Mark Farner was really going to town.
I know when I saw him on the show last year, he didn't mention anything.
Well,
he wasn't thumping anything, you know.
Because at one point he had a car with, you know, all painted up, and he was, you know, he'd take his instruments and go to barn and do these revivals and stuff, and I think it was pretty intense. Of course, I don't think that you can put that in the contract, you can't talk, but he is right, your right to do it. It's just that, you know, I mean...
But he was screwed, so, by the drummer, so whatever, you know, that's neither here nor there. And then, of course, we've gone into the comic book podcast with no direction, so we got out of it. We got out of comic book into something else.
Yeah, listen, we don't play them, but listen to some Grand Funk Railroad. You won't go wrong.
Especially the earlier ones.
It was still tied in because Walt Simonson did Shining On.
I know, but he didn't play on the record.
He did the cover, though, and he did a really nice one.
He didn't sing
the
Locomotion or anything like that. But you could buy it, though.
Yeah.
Support Walt Simonson if he's still getting any royalties from it.
I wonder. Oh, he posted on Facebook. That's how I found he did it, and he's happy, you know. So I don't know
who gets the royalties for those album covers. I guess it's kind of like ends at some point
or
something.
Yeah, I imagine. But
it's kind of like comic books.
I'd be happy if I did the cover and, you know, people saw
it. Remember that comic book reprints never got any royalties back in the day. I think now. Yeah. You get something if it gets turned into a trade paperback or whatever. You know, but back in the old days, when Marvel went into their massive reprint to, like, flood the market era in the mid-70s, I don't think anybody got paid for any of those books.
Yeah, but that's, you know, it's like the Seinfeld cast. That was a big thing. When they did the Seinfeld TV show, it was in their contracts with the main four actors that they'd also get DVD rights. And they put all those DVD sets, and that's nice. Next thing you know, they're on Netflix, and they're on Hulu, and they're on everything. Not in the contracts. It's Jerry Seinfeld and I guess Larry David.
And
somebody else did some show, and they put all future publishing rights in any form. But, you know, you don't think. These guys doing comic books, I know they weren't thinking that these things were...
Back then,
it was disposable.
It was a paycheck.
You know, it's like some of these things you just don't think it's going to be around that much longer, but you still got to do the work. And I mean, we're doing a podcast about these creators that we love with all of our hearts, you know, and some that we don't like as much, but we still talk highly of them. So
yeah, there you go.
That's something, you know.
But it's still kind of cheesy that in the 90s they were still pulling that crap. In the 60s, it was okay, you know, it was kind of like common, you know, deal where it was like, but to be doing that, pulling that stunt in the 90s, but whatever, man. And they all made, I mean, What's-Her-Face is doing great now. Julia Louis-Dreyfus, the other guys, you know, I don't know how much Seinfeld's got more money than, more jacked than...
They all made a lot of money.
Larry David's richer, even richer, so, you know, good for them. So anyway, we're going to do one more Lollapalooza or Comic Palooza or Pull-a-Palooza or whatever. Yeah, I'll grab a book and then we'll end this puppy. see, that one.
Okie dokie. I'm glad.
Oh, wait a minute. Another Tarzan? You want to do another Tarzan?
I do want to talk about that. Open that one up. Is that it?
Oh, it's got some Murphy Anderson on the back.
Okay, I bought a bunch of Tarzans when I was there, but I put these three in the pile just because I did want to talk about them. Okay, actually, I have no idea why I put this one in.
Is the first story by...
It's all Kubert.
Well, it's Murphy Anderson in the back.
This is what I guess I wanted to talk about was the back. And the front story is a really nice Joe Kubert story all the way through. The second story is Edgar Rice Burroughs' backup. It's called Beyond the Farthest Star, and Murphy Anderson drew it. And it's I think he's a pilot that ends up in some other world.
Uh-huh.
And it's a short, like, five-page story, six-page story. And then the next issue is a completely different artist. Hmm. And then I think the next issue, it was gone. And that was something I found strange in Tarzan. Like,
I don't even remember. I never had this issue. Huh.
You know, in the Tarzan books, the first DC issue, it had John Carter, Warlord of Mars by Murphy Anderson. And I think the second issue had something else. Well, what happened to John Carter? And it just seemed like it was kind of haphazard, the backups. Some of them didn't have backups. Some of them had a backup, and then I guess they put the... John Carter, I guess, went to Weird Worlds.
Yeah.
And,
Or he was either before or after that. I don't even know when.
But while we're talking, I'll cheat.
Now, you know, Murphy Anderson did the John Carter, but some of them were done by Greg Morrow.
I haven't seen those. I would like to. Now, this is another Tarzan issue I've got, and I brought it in.
This is Bernd Hogarth.
It's got a Joe Kubert framing sequence, and then it turns into... That's what I was wondering. It must be Bernd Hogarth.
Yeah, it's Bernd Hogarth.
But I have to admit, Bernd Hogarth and Joe Kubert are completely different artists, but when I'm reading this now, I didn't even notice the difference. And then later I said, well, this isn't Joe Kubert. And I couldn't quite tell exactly who it was. But if you're not paying attention, it flows pretty well. The framing sequence isn't jarring. But, you know, at the end of it, after it's over, Joe Kubert finished it up again.
Sometimes Bernd Hogarth's work, however nicely drawn it is, and of course the anatomy is good, it seems a little unnatural to me. You know what I mean? People are not posing naturally, and I don't know. There's something about it. Of course, they were all like influenced by Hal Foster, who did Tarzan. Even this one, look at how weird that. Look at this figure here. That's like the perspective's totally screwed up on this. You know, like these figures here, and then this guy here. What is he, like a little guy, and these guys in the back? Yeah, there's something about Hogarth. I think he was more preoccupied with anatomy than the rest of the work. Sometimes I don't know.
Bernd Hogarth. I saw him in Dallas, Texas, in 1982. And my friend Britt kept talking about him. He did all those anatomy books that were so famous. And he had drawn Tarzan. And I tell you, I've never seen a more eloquent and charming human being. He was just, he's a fantastic speaker. I was just enamored by him. And I loved hearing him speak. He spoke to us with, again, eloquent, but humility. He wasn't egotistical or anything. But you just felt like you didn't know anything when he spoke. I mean, he was just in... He had a... I guess it was a portfolio or illustrations he drew of King Arthur. And all of us, you know, we're all like, you know, high school, college age, you know. And we're all around him, and he's talking to us with great conviction and excitement. And he pulls out these plates, and he goes over each one. And he was talking about the body language and why Guinevere was here and what the sword symbolized. And, you know, it was like six plates. And I thought, my God. And they were fantastic, the drawings. And, you know, you're looking at those and then you're looking at your own stuff and, God, I just don't measure up. And, I mean, and I saw him on a panel with five other guys that I didn't know who they were. And he would, you know, the other guys basically went up there and had nothing to say or being kind of silly. And he was very patient listening to him. Then he'd start talking about to all the young people, he said, if you want to be an artist, try to find your own style. And he kept stressing that, and he said, who would you rather hire, Frank Frazetta or Boris? And he wasn't putting Boris down, but he was saying that, you know, if you had your druthers, you'd hire Frazetta. So try not to draw like Frazetta, try to draw like you. And I just found him fantastic. Well, he did Eclipse, somebody published a new comic book work he did called Swords of Salazar or something. I saw it at Wilson's once for a dollar. I bought it back in 82, and I didn't like it that much. You know, and what you said about his Tarzan work, and I've heard this about his anatomy work, that it's really not a good anatomy book. It's like...
it's good to begin with, but it's not a great one.
Yeah, but he said the anatomy is off, and he renders everything pretty heavy. He says...
sure does.
But it says... it's a slick gloss to it, I guess, but they're not really quite right. And I always hear that about Bernd Hogarth. I thought the world of him. I'll never forget that time I saw him in Dallas and how he talked. He was fantastic, but I see his work. I think it's good, but I don't buy it, you know.
Yeah, he made a lot of money off those anatomy books. Plus, he was one of the big shots at the School of Visual Arts too. That's where he was a big teacher there. So
I could see him as a teacher though, because he gave a lot of philosophy. Again, there was so much to everything he said. He wasn't just a guy that do this.
Talker.
Yeah, it's like if an artist, a really good artist, you know, illustrated his class, all of his word balloons would be full of flowers and, you know, really neat ornamental things. That's kind of how he was, you know. But, and I, like I said, this issue, that's why I brought, I wanted to talk about, was it wasn't Joe Kubert. I guess he did a framing sequence, but they were just throwing in some reprint stories. But it wasn't like buying a Neil Adams book and Irv Novik drew it instead, you know. It was kind of neat.
I know, that's weird. I think there was another one of these Tarzan books where they had Hal Foster strips in it, too. It was a giant-sized one or whatever. And then there was...
oh, that was the dollar books, right?
It was I guess it was a dollar. I don't even remember. There's some of this stuff here. Like, I think this back up here is by Hal Foster. Yep, Land of the Pygmies. This stuff here is by Hal Foster.
I think it says Hal Foster.
Yeah, it sure does. And I seem to remember there was one time there was this little front part here. It was like a little, it was like an intro to the letters page or...
Roy Krinkle,
but it's not in this one.
I think it was in the Weird Worlds or something. It was John Carter.
Was it in John Carter? Yeah, most of this book, this is Tarzan 211. Most of it is Joe Kubert, but yeah, there's the, and Joe Kubert kind of had to like, kind of imitate the Bernd Hogarth characters or whatever. It's probably taken from strips.
He did a good job. Yeah, they just reworked the strips, I think. I don't think Bernd Hogarth did the comic book, did he?
No. I think it was taken from strips or whatever.
Russ Manning drew the comic, I think.
I liked his work on some things, Russ Manning, but not on Tarzan. Even though I've seen some other things that he did at Tarzan that were really nice, but I never liked his Tarzan work or Korak or anything like that in the books, but I have seen other work by him, like Magnus and stuff like that I really liked a lot.
You know, Russ Manning, I all those books you talked about I bought when I was a kid from Gold Key.
Yeah.
And I guess the thing was he was good, but he didn't spend as much time on the work. Steve Rude reminds me a lot of Russ Manning. Mm-hmm. You know, some of it.
But Steve Rude's also a lot like Andrew Loomis. He's another teacher artist, but he was a
he
artist.
Draws really heavy from Andrew Loomis, but he has the way he draws faces and stuff, and some it he took from Russ Manning.
Mm-hmm.
But
well, Nexus kind of like in the same vein as Magnus.
And
or
Space
whatever.
Ghost. Well, there was a 2-issue series where Magnus and Nexus and Magnus met up.
Oh, Magnus? I thought it was Space Ghost. I don't know.
No, Steve Rude and Mark Evanier did a Space Ghost story, but Space Ghost was never in Nexus.
Okay, I
thought it was. I'm trying to think who it was. I don't know if it was Dark Horse and Kimiko or Valiant. But there was 2 issues they did. It was Nexus and Magnus. And Baron and Rude drew it. And it was good. I liked it.
Yeah. All right, man.
Oh, one more.
You want to do another one? Wow, we're getting like into like hour and a half.
Okay. Well, just one more.
We'll just do one more, and then we'll call it a day. All right, go ahead.
All right.
What is it?
All right.
Oh, we talked about that last
time. No, we talked about 101. We did kind of talk about this one. This is Avengers 100, and it was drawn by Barry Smith.
Really nicely, actually.
Yeah, I have to admit. Yeah, this is inked by Smith, Sennett, and Shores. So I guess it's Joe Sennett and Sid Shores?
Yep.
Roy Thomas wrote it?
Yep.
Is this the last work he did with Marvel before, I guess he
isn't that right before Conan?
I think it was during Conan, because the Conan work looked a little simpler, the early Conan work.
Okay.
I couldn't tell you. Let's see here. When was this printed? 72.
Yeah.
I guess you're
Conan.
Right.
It was after Conan, wasn't
yeah.
it?
Conan was 71.
I think so, yeah. His style had already changed by that point.
Yeah, boy,
it became more like the Barry Smith.
I've never really seen it. I've just seen the cover. This is really good.
Yeah, remember the earlier stuff that he did? It wasn't as good.
Well, it looked like he was trying to draw a lot like Jack Kirby.
Yeah, kind of.
But you know, Howard Chaykin always said that when he started, he says, you know, he said Bernie Wrightson and Michael Kaluta came out fully formed. You know, and he says, but everybody saw me grow up in the comics industry, and he talks about his early work, which I see the early work, and I still think is good. But, you know, he completely, you know, he got
he
better
evolved.
And changed, yeah. Well, everybody does. A lot of cartoonists I see start out just really strong, even if it's primitive work, the work is strong, and then some of them, as they get older, they just get worse. You know, some of them never stop being good.
Yeah, but Barry Smith, when he took over Conan, his work just changed completely. I think that's what changed him a little bit. I think he also moved back to England or something. I don't know if he was doing those Conans in the U.S. So maybe like the change of scenery helped him out a little bit or something. But yeah, that's definitely like right after Conan or right during the middle of Conan. It's
yeah, I think
nice.
I think he got deported.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, because he overstayed his visa or whatever. And then he went back and then he came back again. And then he's been here since, I believe. I'm not sure if he's... I think he's still living in the U.S.
Yeah, I think so, too.
But yeah, this is like one of his better superhero books from that era. You know, I look back at the Daredevil and the stuff that he did. And it's kind of like... It's got, like I said, the charm to it or whatever.
Yeah.
But I think this is a more fully... Like you said, a more fully formed Barry Smith. And it's a great comic book.
It is, and some of the X-Men work he did, which I liked, you know, the later work he was doing in the 80s, he came back.
Yeah, I liked it too, yeah.
I liked it, but he got too far into Barry Smith world. You know, like, guys like us, you read it and think, man, this is incredible, but one of my best friends on the ship, his wife just never understood why I like comic books, and I had, I don't know if it was an X-Men or if it was, what was that kid's comic that Louise Simonson wrote? Power Pack. He drew an issue where, I think it was X-Men, where it was Wolverine and the youngest girl in Power Pack. And Julie just goes, oh, that looks like a nightmare. Well, you know, it was really harsh. And when I look at that Avengers 100, it looks like it's Barry Smith with that pre-Raphaelite style he created. Or came up with, but it still has an innocence of loving comic books. You know, the later work started getting more
artsy.
Yeah,
as opposed to like you know, he still had a little bit of Kirby.
Yeah,
in him at this point
had a softness to him.
yeah, definitely. Yeah, more. Yeah, he definitely became more the artist than the comic book artist. But I'm telling you, even some of the more the Weapon X stuff that he did or whatever, that was still strong work back in the 80s. And
yeah, Dallas lent that to me. He had the trade of that stuff. It is good. I didn't want to go buy it, but it was
and
good.
And you liked the oversized book.
Yeah.
The Young God.
Oh, yeah. He
stuff.
Never... He still got the chops.
And that was a little more Kirby-ish.
I will say that work he was doing for, I don't know if it was Valiant or Defiant. What was it? Rune and Archer and Armstrong.
Yeah,
I think it was Valiant. I never bought those. And I used to see them on the stands, and I've seen them in dollar boxes. And I've heard some guy carrying on about Archer and Armstrong. And that, what was that work, Freebooters, that I like so much. When I was reading about it, people said that they think that what he did is he just took the Archer and Armstrong characters and turned them into the, you know, Conan-type saga. Well, reading that and seeing some of those books, yeah, I guess that's kind of what he did. Of course, maybe it's different, but, you know, one was kind of an over-the-hill heavy guy, and the other one was a young, you know, idealistic guy.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I love Barry Smith, but I've never had any interest in reading those books, so.
There you go.
Anyway, that's a sour note to end the show.
Well, you know, I hope Barry Smith comes back and does comics again. I'd like to see his work in
He hasn't
books.
Done anything
else?
I
don't think so. Not that I know of, anyway. You know, I mean, maybe I missed something because there's plenty of books that come out and you never hear about.
Oh, that's easy to do, isn't it?
But I don't know if he's done anything in a while. He might be still doing just commissions and stuff like that. So.
Or working on another field.
All right, man.
All right, well, listen, thanks for listening. And if you wouldn't mind, if you listen to us through iTunes, iTunes review really helps us out a lot. Like us, hate us, write a review. Anyway, hopefully the whole crew will be back soon. And in the meantime,
read more comics.
You can find Al's other podcast, Slow Robot A Go-Go, Dallas's webcomic, The Mighty Blue, and Al's blog, Destination Nightmare, on the sidebar of our blog at bunchofdorks.com.
And click on the Cyclops!